Man, it feels so weird to see you remotely again.
I know. I'm just used to being at your place. A week ago today, I was hanging out. We were getting ready to watch the national championship, and we were totally wrong, by the way.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that went downhill quick for the Tar Heels.
Wow. Who would have thought?
Who would have thunk?
Not after watching that first half, I didn't think that.
Yeah. You know, one thing I didn't ask you when you were out here last week was, do you like black licorice?
No, I'm a red licorice guy.
You're a red licorice guy. Okay. I've yet to find somebody who likes black licorice like me. It's one of the, like, my passions when it comes to like junk food and stuff. I eat bags of it every week.
It can't be good for you.
Small bags. But yeah, it's supposed to be good for your stomach. That's the way I justify it.
What's your favorite chip? I went to the store today and I bought some chips, and I want to see, like, you probably are not a big chip eater.
Why would you say that? Because I'm just so physically fit.
Well, I went to your house. I didn't see a whole lot of junk food lying around.
Here's the problem with chips. You get a bag of chips with six kids, it's gone, like, within 2 minutes of it hitting the door.
So you don't even get a chip.
You don't even get the chip. I would say we default to like Sun Chips, Harvest Cheddar, or Harvest Cheddar, I think, and then the Garden Salsa one.
I like both of those.
We're big into like just chips and salsa. May makes a pretty good salsa.
Gotcha.
So what about you?
Good old Cheetos, Doritos. I'm just anything but like a sour cream type chip.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
No ranch style or any of that kind of stuff. Just give me a chip with seasoning on it and I'm eating it. So I love Takis too.
Okay. I don't even know what that is.
They're like a hot, like flaming hot Doritos or flaming hot. Kind of the originator of that. They're a Mexican brand of chips. They're really good.
Wow. All right.
They're mainstream down here in Texas. So Takis. If anybody likes Takis, put it down below. All right. We have an agenda today. We have a few things. Now, one thing we mentioned last week that we may have to do as a separate video, because we didn't talk about this before, but someone did hit the first major league home run and we were going to give away a box. Remember?
Yeah. And no one guessed it correctly.
Oh, really?
It was Nico Horner who hit the first home run. And then no one, at least when I went back and looked the first time, had guessed it. So if I see any edit next to your comment, I'm automatically disqualifying you, especially if it's Nico Horner. But Nico Horner was the first home run of the year.
Well, then we'll have to figure out how to give that box away a different way.
We will. Let's randomize that. Let's you and I talk. We'll randomize both of the boxes off next show to anyone that commented in those videos, in that video.
Seems reasonable.
Reasonable. Since
we're all bad guessers. So I'm in a fantasy league this year for the first time in a long time. I don't usually do fantasy baseball, but a bunch of YouTube guys were doing a league.
Yep.
And after the first weekend, which was fun to watch, you know, there was a lot, but I'm finding I'm paying way more attention to it, of what's going on around the league. And B, my team has no power. I have zero home runs after 4 days and only 5 RBIs. So I'm in trouble.
You're in trouble for sure. Is it one of those you get points for home runs, RBIs, that's it?
No, it's a pretty intricate point system, actually. Okay. I don't need to belabor it here, but it's fun that way. I like that part of it because a lot of things can get you points. But, I mean, like you'll end up with 600 points for the week. Like it's that big of a point system.
Jeez. Okay. It's probably kind of fun though. You know, it feels like you're accomplishing something when you have 600 points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you still might lose, but anyway.
Anyway,
it's fun to be doing that again. I know you're probably like in 10 fantasy baseball.
No, not one.
Really?
Not one. Nope. I think I've played fantasy baseball one time in my entire life.
I like it as long as what I don't like is the daily.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many games.
For sure.
You have to switch out your lineup. I think I'm going to get to a point where I just go, here's my 9 guys, you know.
Yeah.
And my pitching staff, whatever happens, happens. If guys have the day off and I don't switch out the catcher, whatever.
Right.
Whatever.
Yeah. 3 months from now, you're going to be like, I don't even remember what's happening with my team.
Right.
You're going to be that guy.
And I'll be in last place, and that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. We do have some stuff to talk about. Like you just said, let's talk about the big one that just came out a couple hours ago. And I don't think it's a surprise really to anybody, but HJ announced that Tyler Hitt is stepping away from hybrid grading. It was his dream, apparently, and the company wouldn't be where it is today without his knowledge and love for the industry. It looks like he sold to Armstrong International, which we'll talk about here in a second. Just note that they say in this Instagram post that Armstrong International is a private fifth-generation family-owned company, which is pulled directly from their website, and that they apparently have a strong passion for the card industry, which is what drew them to HGA in the first place. We'll talk about Armstrong here in a sec. They're getting absolutely roasted in the comment sections on Instagram. I don't know if it's like that on Facebook. It hasn't been a good last few months for HGA, period. But what was your reaction to that news when you saw it?
The first thing I thought was good for Tyler. Like, isn't the whole point of building a business and to ultimately sell out and make a mint? And that's Tyler's MO anyway. I mean, he's a kind of serial entrepreneur. He just builds a business, does that. He loves sports cards. Decided to put some time and effort into that for a couple of years, and then he got the payday. I mean, I don't blame him one bit.
Yeah, it's tough because I'm coming from the perspective of interviewing him, talking to him a few times, you know, offline, and kind of hearing what his motive was. I mean, he told me point blank, he didn't want to sell to a VC firm. Like, that was not his intent. He was passionate about unseating PSA because he had been burned by them. And he refused to take money. And that was, you know, back when they started after an interview with him. To see this happen and to also know that there is a massive backlog that they have not yet worked through. I don't know. I don't have any cards there. I don't have any really personal interest at all in it outside of what I just kind of heard.
Well, the idea and dream, the dream of unseating PSA was going to always stay right there as a dream. And I'm glad that was his motivation and his goal. But the reality of it was nobody's going to unseat PSA. I'm sorry. SGC's not.
For sure. For sure.
HGA wasn't. CSG is not. BBG certainly isn't. I think he saw the writing on the wall. Wow, I can't scale this the way it needs to be scaled. And personally, you know, personally financing it, I can't do it. Let me bring on a partner / takeover kind of deal and get it to where it needs to be. I don't think Tyler's leaving completely. I think that was part of the news release. But he's definitely been bought out. He's not the boss anymore. And I'd say, hey, a good businessman knows when to, you know, take the money and run.
Yeah. I mean, he probably missed the opportunity 6 months ago, I would guess, to get a lot more money, and he had to make a decision now or never. So yeah, I'm with you. It takes a different person to start a business many times than it does to run a business. Right. I think someone mentioned that in a comment that I saw, and that's such a true statement. Right. And people forget that. It's easy to roast somebody. But if you are a believer in HGA, you probably want to see this, because Tyler obviously wasn't the guy to kind of execute things. Now, here's the thing that I find interesting, right? They talk about Armstrong being interested in the hobby, which is why they gravitated towards HGA. Here's a little snippet from their website. This is what they do now. Here's some case studies they have. Intelligent solutions for customers in higher ed, healthcare, power, HPI, food, beverage, hospitality, pharmaceuticals, and more. They've been a trusted provider of intelligent solutions in steam, air, and hot water for a wide and growing range of industries. Here's another snippet from their website. This is the industries they work in: products and systems, optimization services. I want to be honest, nothing here screams a passion for sports cards from Armstrong specifically.
Well, maybe there's some people deep in the bowels of the company that want to be get in the sports card world. I mean, who really knows? There's money to be made in the grading space, even at a small scale like HGA was.
Yeah.
And I think given the right opportunities, I mean, look, HGA, the thing they have going for them is their unique labels, right? Their flips. I actually like them a lot. Not enough that I'm going to switch how I do my collection, but I bought a few HGA slabs and I really like them. So then you worry, you know, what were their issues then? Quality control, getting backlogged just like everyone else, you know, not being able to take on the, but I do think we need multiple grading companies in the space. I think if you only have one, that's not good. Mm-hmm. For competition, for innovation, for all of the different reasons why competition is good in any industry. Price stays somewhat muted or can, unless there's collusion. But
yep.
So that's my thoughts.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all, right? We have SGC, we have BGS, we have other, you know, bottom feeders kind of starting up and usually not lasting very long. HGA felt like they were doing something a little bit unique in the space with their flips and the custom designs that you could do. But to me, it ultimately came down to you can talk the talk, but you got to walk the walk. And the hobby sees through stuff pretty quickly. And I felt like they missed the opportunity to be unique and kind of stand on their vision when they could not execute on things they promised. It's hard to recover from that. It really is hard.
Didn't they try to avoid it from the very beginning by having quotas every week? You know,
right?
Norman's down here.
yeah.
You know, by saying, "Look, we'll only grade a certain number of cards every week to keep from getting backlogged."
Yeah.
You know, look how that worked out.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, right? You like their flip. You like their design, but yet you will not sub to them. That's what they could not get past. They couldn't get a guy like you who actually likes them to go sub with them. It is really, really hard to get a hobbyist to change the way they do things.
Yes, it is. And it's hard to get my dog to cooperate while I'm on a show with Ty.
We talked a lot about him last week.
Jeez. All right. Yeah, I'm not going to. You've got so much ingrained loyalty, good and bad.
Yeah. Right?
I'm not saying that my loyalty to PSA is a good thing necessarily. It's just I'm already in it. You know, I'm deep in it, and a lot of people are.
Completely agree. What's your prediction for HGA in the next 6 to 12 months? What do you think happens?
I think they're still in business.
Okay.
First and foremost, that's probably the most important thing if people are worried about that. I think this doesn't mean they're going out of business. In fact, I think Omar said it on he did a video about this earlier on Retro Hoop Collectibles about VC companies don't come in like this. Private equity companies don't come in to buy a dying business. They're seeing opportunity to turn it around and make it even better. I don't know what that means, but that's what they're going to try to do. Meaning, I don't know how that's going to look. And so, I don't know is the real answer to your question, but I think they're still in business. What do you think? Do you have any?
Yeah. Thoughts? Well, I think VC firms many times will jump in to buy floundering businesses that maybe are in a sector, a marketplace that has a lot of opportunity, but the business itself is floundering and maybe dying on its own. Which I think is probably the case with HGA. I don't think they were sustainable.
Okay. Under their previous iteration.
The sports car market was declining. PSA was lowering rates. SGC was killing it. BGS spun back up. There's no way HGA was going to be around at the current rate in the next 12 months. So I think they probably saved HGA.
What can they do different to change that trajectory?
Yeah. I mean, from the looks of the way Armstrong is set up, they're going to come in and create a highly optimized, highly efficient grading business that at least turns out turns out slabs quicker and gets people their orders, maybe that's enough to kind of keep HGA relevant. My prediction is no one's even talking about HGA in the next 12 months.
It's funny that we're spending a whole segment of our show on the fifth or sixth largest grading company. And if people are asking, why are you spending so much time talking about a relatively irrelevant player in that market? It's because to me, it shows why it's important to pay attention to stuff like this is it shows that there is still money out there wanting to invest in the hobby in some way, shape or form. And that's good for the long-term health of the hobby.
Yeah.
Again, what does that mean for HGA specifically? Neither one of us know, but it's an indication that there is still money out there, big money, most likely. I mean, we're not talking, HGA wasn't cheap, right? He didn't sell it for, you know, pennies on the dollar. And so it wasn't a fire sale kind of thing. And I think that that gets him, you know, I think that's good for the hobby.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't disagree at all. At all. Speaking of, are you done comments on HGA? I want to shift topics a little bit.
The other point would be, you know, if anybody wants to buy out Bench Clear, feel free to send us an offer.
Another dying business. We're floundering.
Yeah. Okay.
Joking. So you're not big into the Twitter world, correct? Nope. At all?
Nope.
It's probably all over Instagram as well, maybe even Facebook. But Panini came out with their WWE release 2 weeks ago, and it exploded, right? It absolutely exploded, and cards were going crazy on eBay. Color blasts were coming out and going for tens of thousands of dollars. And just like we've seen from some other recent faddish type products, and I'm not saying WWE is a fad. I know it's got a strong kind of base of collectors. We see a lot of the top end stuff come out, get bid up like crazy. And what a lot of people that aren't in the know or have the, you know, take the time to go learn about this don't realize is that most of those auctions weren't being paid for. And all of a sudden you see prices plummet, you know, cards selling for 30,000 or selling for 4,000, you know, selling for 4,000. And you see that with the VFriend stuff. We saw that with Project 2020. We've seen it with a lot of the NFT world. And you and I were talking about this offline. There's a massive, I don't know, misunderstanding from the market, but also a lot of us lose a lot of money because people don't know how to read comps right. There's a lot of shilling that takes place. And the prices that we think exist are actually just inflated numbers from a part of the market that tries to drive up artificial pricing. How long has that been going on, for one? And two, do you just kind of accept that as part of the deal now? I mean, what's your read on that?
Well, it's been around as long as eBay has been around. So mid-90s, right? Late 90s. I got my first eBay account in 1998. So a lot of people watching this weren't even born in 1998. But point being that that's always happened.
Yeah.
And there were certain sellers that were just, you know, even Rick Probstein, who I buy stuff from to this day, his auctions have been accused of shilling. I don't think Rick himself does the shilling or anybody on his team, but if you consigned a card to Probstein, hey, Mike, my card's on Probstein, go bid on it. You know, if you win, you don't have to pay me for it, but just, you know what I mean? That kind of crap happens all the time. And it doesn't even have to be with a big consigner. It can be you selling your cards and you calling me, hey, Mike, bid this up. I think the guy's on the hook for more money. It is hard to fix, hard for eBay to fix in terms of keeping shillers out of bidding.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you're listing the card in Idaho. I'm in Texas making the bid.
Right.
How would they possibly link those two things together if I was doing that? And so I always say, like on Rick's Probstein's auctions, we call it the Ricky tax. If you buy a Probstein auction, you know you're going to pay a little bit more than you would have from any other seller, because there are people manipulating, paying attention to. Maybe I'm being naive. Maybe I'm being not naive. I'm being probably accusatory. Maybe just more people watch Ricky's auctions. I don't know. And they end up bidding on them. But the same card, same grade, will sell more in a Probstein auction than it will in anyone else auction.
Yeah.
And that's just truth.
Yeah.
And I've accepted it. I can't change it. So.
Well, here's the problem, right? It affects people in so many ways, especially normal buyers. You go to a show, you pull up a comp that you look at with completed listings, and in its current state, eBay's not doing anything to clean up the auctions that maybe weren't paid for, which I think is the low hanging fruit, right? You got a check mark for eBay authentication now. How about a check mark for guaranteed paid? How hard would that be?
Right.
You know, like that way we know that it was a paid auction, or if it's not paid, remove it from the sold listing. So that way people, I mean, they don't really care, I'm guessing, because they hide that a lot of times in the prices, and they don't care what things are selling from the secondary market. But that's the worst part about this, is that people overpay for items that really were not fair comps.
I've also never understood why best offer accepteds are just, why don't they just put the price that the best offer was accepted at? Why does that? Yeah. Why is that such a secret?
Yeah, it's never made sense to me.
I don't understand it. So that would be, because if it's a $3,000 card that's crossed out, doesn't really tell you anything.
Well, you know why eBay does that, right?
Why?
Well, because they don't want to drive down prices of other cards listed currently, or not just cards, any other item that's similar, because if it lowers the price, they get paid less in final value fees.
Okay, but it's, it's
right.
Hilarious. That feels so dirty.
There's nothing in writing that says that, right? But that to me is why they would do that. You have a $1,000 card best offer. It sells for $600, but it shows $1,000. No one really knows. So the uncertainty drives up prices and keeps them kind of inflated, and eBay makes more money on the deal. If it shows $600, that drives down prices for that comparable item, lower and lower and lower. I don't know. That's just what I think, but either way, it's frustrating, right? It's frustrating.
Now, how, like, can you tell? You said a lot of these WWE cards are not being paid for. Like, how do you know that they're not being paid for?
Yeah, and that's why I kind of referenced Twitter. A lot of people on Twitter talking about sellers of these cards frustrated because they aren't getting paid on them.
Oh, gotcha. So. Yeah. Okay. So a person on Twitter is like, I just sold this card for $30,000, but the dude hasn't paid me.
Right.
Okay.
Got to relist it. Now it's down to 12. Got to relist it again. No one paid for it. Now it's down to 5. You know, like that is how it typically works. We see it on a lower sale with the new release of baseball card products, right? Top Series 1 comes out. Wander Franco base card selling for $50. You know, like, guys, most times those aren't being paid for. Like, it's just someone setting the market with a friend or something. And that unfortunately causes somebody else to go overpay for a card.
Well, I've always, new releases is a great example, because there's a frenzy typically in the first couple of weeks of a release, right? Topps Heritage, same deal. Yeah. There's a reason why Brent and Becca want to be the first people to put their card out there, you know, of a certain card, because they know that's where you're going to get max value, max price. I'm a post frenzy kind of guy. I wait a few weeks for the next thing to come along to drag the attention away from whatever newer release there was, and then pick up cards from that I would want. Been doing that for a long, long time. Yeah. Unless it's a one of one, there's going to be another one, and somebody's going to pull it, and somebody's going to list it. And this FOMO idea that people have, this friend that creates this frenzy, right? During the initial release of a product, or Project 2020 was different, actually, a little bit different, because every time they would release cards every day, you know, you didn't, and they would print as many as people ordered. So it wasn't like there was a limited amount of any given card every day. You could, I could order 10, I could order 100, I could order 1,000, and I would get them. So it was a different kind of frenzy.
Yep.
Based on scarcity from previous ones that created this recency bias of perceived scarcity for future value, for future issues, which didn't materialize, and we blew up with the Shore Griffey, and that was the end of Project 2020. So, which I think every man, woman, and child in the United States has a Shore Griffey at this point. Not really, but I just think I think that was a different situation, but I do think it does happen now. Pretty much any big, you know, Bowman's about to come out. That's going to happen with that.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that happens in every case. I sold Garbage Pail Kids for a long time. I would open cases of that, you know, years ago. And I had a couple guys that regardless of, I mean, day one, I would put stuff up at peak prices and I'd get a bite. Now this, and guys would just buy it because they had the cash. They were wealthy. They didn't even care if they could save money waiting 2 weeks. Give it to me, buy it now, cash here, go give it to me. Like that was it every single time. There are lots of those buyers out there. But to your point, non-numbered stuff, cards that we perceive as being scarce that aren't, get inflated really quickly and they come crashing down just as quick. And there's no account of it. It's the nature of it for sure. I saw a couple posts recently. This is kind of in the same ballpark of this conversation, but I saw a post earlier today from a guy who said he got caught up in the FOMO sports cards, you know, 9 months ago and, you know, bought a ton of basketball and a ton of football. And now was dealing with the repercussions of cards being down 50%. And he put it all on credit cards. Right. And we're not getting into all this right now, but the FOMO of all that drove him to purchase something because he saw all the other sold listings.
Right.
God, he was doing it. He was, you know, buying it at good prices. Sadly, it's crushed him now. So
it happens. Just buy vintage. That's the moral of the story.
Yeah. And the reason that doesn't happen in vintage is because vintage buyers aren't thinking I'm going to go buy this to go flip it and get it out of my hands as quick as possible. They're buying it and it's being tucked away. Look at that.
Tucked away.
And they can call for that though.
And I think vintage buyers, not everyone, but by and large are longer term collectors. They've been through the ups and downs. They've seen it, you know, been there, done that, got the t-shirt kind of thing. And they're not as impatient.
Yeah.
There's not a ton of FOMO. Now you see that when a player dies, let's say Willie Mays was to die tomorrow, his cards would spike quickly because people go, oh crap, that Willie Mays that I had been wanting to buy, I never did it. I need to go get it now before it really goes up, you know, that whole thing. So there's usually a quick run up and then it kind of trickles back to a new level. But that's the only time that really happens in the vintage world.
Right. Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense.
What else we got?
That's about it, man. We're trying to keep it to 30 minutes. We're at 29.
What do you got this week?
We got a couple things coming out. So you remember the video I did about 2.5 months ago on don't buy graded cards until you see this. I have updated data to share with everybody on the graded card market.
So that'll be over on your other channel.
No, it'll be here.
It'll be on Bench Clear. Yep. Okay.
Yep. Be on Bench Clear and I'm excited that you're going to like it.
I loved it. The last one, I geeked out over it and you know me, I'm a numbers guy.
Oh yeah.
I've got Golden Age of Cardboard. I'm doing a solo episode this week and I'm going to dive deep into 1952 tops. I got a couple of 52 tops cards over the weekend. And people have been asking me to do kind of in-depth dives into certain years and sets. And I think I'm going to start that as kind of a random series that I'll do pretty much in perpetuity, but I'll always have a set in a year I can do an episode on any given week if I need to fill the content void. I'm also going to be on Hobby Hotline tomorrow night, Tuesday night. I think I'm hosting that I mean, I'm the showrunner, I guess, is what they call it. And
there you go.
A couple other baseball collector things, I'm sure. But
yeah.
Do we have more stuff coming out from the Missoula show?
We do. We have a card challenge that will be out later this week. I don't want to share too much about it because it's being edited right now by Matt. That'll be fun. We have a Missoula recap video. That was such a fun show. Man, we talked about it already, but I really had a good time with that show. I can't wait for folks to kind of see.
Yeah, me too.
How much fun we had.
Me too. Different. If you're in that area at all, you should go to the Missoula card show. Be worth
it. Yeah. Yeah. Now we're talking about doing a Coeur d'Alene, Idaho show. That will actually, we as in me, as on the bench clear side, will be a co-host for the show. So more details to come out about that in probably in late June. So if anyone's in the Northwest, Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, Montana, Idaho, the Coeur d'Alene show might be really fun. So if you want a table, shoot me a message below. I'll hook you up.
I think I'm going to be coming. Are you flying me up to be an autograph guest for that? Or
you're too expensive, man. I saw your rates.
Right. No one would care. We got to get some dual autos, though. Mike and Ty.
Yes, we do. That would be fun. It would be fun. By the way, if you guys want shirts, if you see in our show notes, there is a way to buy shirts now. You can custom order a shirt. We have Bench Clear logo shirts. We have one that says yo and hello. I don't know if you've seen that, Mike, but you just click buy and it's printed on demand. Your size, your color, super easy.
Benchclear.us?
No, it's literally on our YouTube, right? Right below in the show notes, the description of this episode right now, drop it down and you'll see items for you to buy right there in the description.
Well, awesome. Yo, that easy. Buy a bunch of yo and hello shirts.
Yes.
Said no one ever.
Said no one ever. Matt told me the day, he said he's thinking about starting a new one called Hello and Yo.
Copyright infringement. I will sue for copyright infringement.
That's right.
No.
That's
right.
That'd be trademark, but whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
Cool, man. Have a good week. Thank you guys for watching.
See you guys.